Hello, welcome back to my study of the life divine. Tonight we take up a new chapter. This is chapter 12 in book 2. It's called The Origin of the Ignorance. It appears in the Arya a good bit later than the last chapter. I think it's chapter 41. The last maybe was chapter 30 in the Arya series. Here it has been heavily revised, but follows the same structure as the original argument. Since we've taken up book 2, we've seen that Sri Aurobindo has been looking at this question of how a cosmos might arise with an individual within it, in time and space, from an absolute being with an infinite consciousness whose self-experience is one of unmitigated delight. And if a cosmos and person could arise within that, then how could it be subjected to the marked limitations of the existence that we see, fronted by ignorance? So this is the question that he's been pursuing now into our 12th chapter here in the second book. And it continues beyond this. Through the rest of Book 2, Sri Aurobindo is working with this principle of ignorance and how it serves as a concentration of consciousness force, not accidentally, but in a sense deeply willed to express in a composite way what are all the riches that lie within the infinite, and which must express themselves serially through the play of time in a long evolution of consciousness. But how do we deal with this lapse into darkness, into even falsehood, error, wrong, evil? For the rest of this book, we'll be dealing with that, and then he'll turn to a different theme for the balance of the life divine. So we have our work to do here, laboring in the fields of the ignorance. So we begin chapter 12, the origin of the ignorance. And note that he says of the ignorance. It's not of ignorance, but of the ignorance, which suggests that this is something that has cosmic standing. This is of great metaphysical significance. His mottos this week are all drawn, as we read them, from the Upanishads, from the Mundaka and the Taittiriya. The first is the Mundaka, the Upanishad of one with the shaved head. And in English it reads, "By energism of consciousness, Brahman is massed. From that, matter is born, and from matter, life and mind and the worlds. Tapasa chiyate brahma." Through this force of consciousness which pulls itself into a tight compass, concentrates itself. Chiyate. From that matter, anam, the same word for food. And from anam comes prana, the life force, comes mind, manas. Then Sri Aurobindo says, comes the worlds, lokaha. It's interesting that he's left out what is also in the verse, satyam, truth. In other words, truth is emergent within this play of consciousness. He's left that out. Perhaps he takes it up later. Then on this idea that it is the concentration of consciousness that expresses this world, he moves to the Taittiriya Upanishad. He desired, may I be many. He concentrated in tapas. By tapas, he created the world. Creating, he entered into it. Entering, he became the existent, sat, and the beyond existence, tyat. He became the expressed, niruktam, and the unexpressed, aniruktam. He became knowledge, vijnana, and ignorance, avijnana. He became the truth, satyam, and the falsehood, anrittam. He became the truth, satyam, even all this whatsoever that is. That truth, satyam iti, they call him. So this speaks directly to this idea that the one becomes the many, becomes the many through the multiplication of its conscious being. It never loses its oneness as it becomes the many. Finally, another from the Taittiriya, energism of consciousness is Brahman. Tapo brahmeti. In other words, tapas brahma iti. Tapas is Brahman. It is the nature of Brahman to compress itself. It is a willful, deliberate, conscious, intentional act to draw itself through the application of great eskesis, generating heat so that from that heating up is manifest the world. So now I think we begin the chapter. It becomes necessary and possible, now that so much has been fixed, to consider at close quarters the problem of the ignorance from the point of view of its pragmatic origin. Pragmatic, what can be done, from the Greek pragma, deed. The process of consciousness, which brought it into existence. It is on the basis of an integral oneness as the truth of existence that we have to consider the problem and see how far the different possible solutions are on this basis applicable. How could this manifold ignorance or this narrowly self-limiting and separative knowledge arise and come into action or maintain itself in action in an absolute being who must be absolute consciousness and therefore cannot be subject to ignorance? So this is our presumption, that this great unknowable, if it can be positively figured, is Satchitananda, is an existence with an infinite consciousness, because its being is infinite and it cannot be absent consciousness wherever its being is. And this is the very ground of anything that is. There can only be that. This is the very foundation of Sri Aurobindo's philosophy. So how could this ignorance, this manyness, arise in absolute oneness of being? He continues, how is even an apparent division effectively operated and kept in continuance in the indivisible? So these are very stern, logically robust questions. The being, integrally one, cannot be ignorant of itself, and since all things are itself, conscious modifications, determinations of its being, it cannot either be ignorant of things, of their true nature, of their true action. But though we say that we are that, that the jivatman or individual self is no other than the paramatman, no other than the absolute, yet we are certainly ignorant both of ourselves and things, from which this contradiction results, that what must be in its very grain incapable of ignorance is yet capable of it, and has plunged itself into it by some will of its being, or some necessity or possibility of its nature. So let's pause and look at some of the terms here. Sri Aurobindo has used the term jivatman once before in the chapter on the triple status of supermind. And there he was referring to the individual self as it emerges from the supreme divine and stands in an unabrogated unity with the supreme and yet is an individual. So there, oneness and manyness are in perfect balance. Here, he's using the term in a less precise sense. This is more or less as it would be used in Vedantic terminology, representing, as he says here, the individual self. Paramatman means supreme self. So that would be the transcendent reality, from which both the cosmic being and the individual being would come. So he is asserting that the individual self is part of that absolute self. Yes, but if it is, then how is it, if we are at core, the jivatman, that we have lapsed into ignorance? Because how could we ever escape the flood of unity and light which the supreme being is? He continues, we do not ease the difficulty if we plead that mind, which is the seat of ignorance, is a thing of maya, non-existent, not Brahman, and that Brahman, the absolute, the sole existence, cannot in any way be touched by the ignorance of mind, which is part of the illusory being, asat, the non-existence. This is an escape which is not open to us if we admit an integral oneness. For then it is evident that in making so radical a distinction and at the same time canceling it by terming it illusory, we are using the magic or maya of thought and word in order to conceal from ourselves that the fact that we are dividing and denying the unity of the Brahman. For we have erected two opposite powers, Brahman incapable of illusion and self-elusive maya, and pitchforked them into an impossible unity. When he uses the term maya here, this is not the idea of the supramental maya, which takes the infinite and converts it into finite form. This is more the traditional sense of the term maya, typically used in Vedanta. If Brahman is the sole existence, maya can be nothing but a power of Brahman, a force of his consciousness, or a result of his being. And if the jivatman, one with Brahman, is subject to its own maya, the Brahman in it is subject to maya. But this is not intrinsically or fundamentally possible. The subjection can only be a submission of something in nature to an action of nature, which is part of the conscious and free movement of the spirit in things, a play of its own self-manifesting omniscience. Ignorance must be part of the movement of the One, a development of its consciousness knowingly adopted, to which it is not forcibly subjected, but which it uses for its cosmic purpose. So we have to look at what this logical contradiction tells us in the use of this Vedantic impersonal terminology to understand that ignorance here has a cosmic utility, and we have to find a way to that. Remember, he began by saying that we're looking for the pragmatic origin. We won't be stopped because of the logical vicissitudes of what reason will tell us about reality. And yet, we have somehow to square that absoluteness of Sat with the division and the darkening of what we see about us in the manifold universe. He continues, it is not open to us to get rid of the whole difficulty by saying that the Jivatman and the Supreme are not one, but eternally different. The one subject to ignorance, the other absolute in being and consciousness, and therefore in knowledge. For this contradicts the supreme experience and the whole experience, which is that of unity in being, whatever difference there may be in the action of nature. This is a critically important point. Oneness is key to every reach of being's self-expression. It is easier, he says, to accept the fact of unity in difference, which is so evident and pervasive in all the building of the universe, and satisfy ourselves with the statement that we are one yet different, one in essential being, and therefore in essential nature, different in soul form, and therefore in active nature. But we thereby only state the fact, leaving the difficulty raised by the fact unsolved. How that which belongs in the essence of its being to the unity of the Absolute, and should therefore be one with it and with all in consciousness, comes to be divided in its dynamic form of self and its activity, and subject to ignorance. So to have that grand unifying experience is a wonderful thing, but that happy conclusion does not solve this ontological problem, and we have to follow a process to understand how it is that this apparent division occurs. Because if the Jivatman is one in essence with the Supreme Being, then the nature of the Supreme Being should also be one in essence with the Jivatman, no? Being and power of being should be the same thing. So why, how would it be that any diminution of knowledge, of consciousness could occur? Why would that lapse happen? He continues now, it is also to be noted that the statement would not be wholly true, since it is possible for the Jivatman to enter into unity with the active nature of the One, and not only into a static essential oneness. We spoke earlier of that second supramental status in which Jivatman arises in the consciousness of the Divine. And here Sri Aurobindo subtly suggests that, of course, the Jivatman can grasp that, because that is its nature. That's where it came into being. Or we may escape the difficulty, he says, by saying that beyond or above existence and its problems, there is the unknowable, which is beyond or above our experience, and that the action of Maya has already begun in the unknowable before the world began, and therefore is itself unknowable and inexplicable in its cause and its origin. You remember Sri Aurobindo spoke in early chapters about this unknowable. He continues, but this would be a sort of idealistic as opposed to a materialistic agnosticism, that is, assigning this first conceptive action of Maya to something within the sphere of the unknowable prior to manifestation. That sort of gives it rear guard action as a possibility. And since it would be so, that could be considered idealistic as opposed to the materialistic agnosticism, which would mean that we can't know things from the basis of our material beginnings. But all agnosticism, he writes, is subject to this objection, that it may be nothing but our refusal to know, a too ready embracing of an apparent and present restriction or constriction of consciousness, a sense of impotence which may be permitted to the immediate limitations of the mind, but not to the Jivatman who is one with the Supreme. The Supreme must surely know himself and the cause of ignorance, and therefore the Jivatman has no ground to despair of any knowledge or deny his capacity of knowing this integral Supreme and the original cause of his own present ignorance. So our present ignorance cannot debar us from a greater knowledge wherein we can know intimately and by identity what is the purpose and the motivation behind this original movement into ignorance. He suggests we can know it. The unknowable, if it is at all, may be a supreme state of Satchit Ananda. Beyond our highest conceptions of existence, consciousness, and bliss, that is what was evidently meant by the Asat, the non-existent of the Taittiriya Upanishad, which alone was in the beginning and out of which the existent was born. And possibly, too, it may be the inmost sense of the Nirvana of the Buddhists, of the Buddha, pardon me. For the dissolution of our present state by Nirvana may be a reaching to some highest state beyond all notion or experience of self, even, an ineffable release from our sense of existence. This idea of the unknowable being the supreme state occurs not only in the Taittiriya, but also in the Chandogya Upanishad. And we can see that in the Upanishad, Sat may escape even the positive description of being. And this was key to Sri Aurobindo's early assessment of the nature of being. We can say of that unknowable, which is free and clear even from the positive definition of itself as Sat, that it cannot be captured, cabined by that idea. Even though Sat is infinite, still the Supreme Divine is free from all definition, escapes even capture by that. So is it that to which Buddha referred when he described that there is no self, anatman? He continues now, or it may be the Upanishad's absolute and unconditioned bliss, which is beyond expression and beyond understanding, because it surpasses all that we can conceive or describe as consciousness and existence. He doesn't translate it for us here, and it's not one of the citations, but this is the Taittiriya Upanishad also. Chapter 2, the fourth section. It reads in English, "From which words turn back, together with the mind, not having attained, aprapya, the bliss of Brahman. He who knows, fears not at any time at all." This is the sense in which we have already accepted it, for the acceptation commits us only to a refusal to put a limit to the ascension of the infinite. Or, if it is not this, if it is something quite different from existence, even from an unconditioned existence, it must be the absolute non-being of the nihilistic thinker. That unconditioned existence, referring to that unknowable again. But out of absolute nothingness, nothing can come. Not even anything merely apparent, not even an illusion. So if there is zero, if there's absolute void, then how could it be possible that anything would arise within it? This is the existential problem that the Upanishads have also faced. And if the absolute non-existence is not that, then it can only be an absolute, eternally unrealized potentiality, an enigmatic zero of the infinite, out of which relative potentialities may at any time emerge, but only some actually succeed in emerging into phenomenal appearance. You can check this out at Chandogya Upanishad 6.2.2. Out of this non-existence, anything may arise, and there is no possibility of saying what or why. It is, for all practical purposes, a seed of absolute chaos, out of which, by some happy or rather unhappy accident, there has emerged the order of a universe. Or we may say that there is no real order of the universe. What we take for such is a persistent habit of the senses and the life and a figment of the mind, and it is useless to seek for an ultimate reason of things. This is existentialism. Out of an absolute chaos, all paradox and absurdity can be born, and the world is such a paradox. A mysterious sum of contraries and puzzles, or it may be, in effect, as some have felt or thought, a huge error, a monstrous and infinite delirium. Of such a universe, not an absolute consciousness and knowledge, but an absolute inconscience and ignorance may be the source. Anything may be true in such a cosmos. Everything may have been born out of nothing. Thinking mind may be only a disease of unthinking force or inconscient matter. Dominant order, which we suppose to be existence according to the truth of things, may be really the mechanical law of an eternal self-ignorance and not the self-evolution of a supreme self-ruling conscious will. Perpetual existence may be the constant phenomenon of an eternal nihil. All opinions about the origins of things become of an equal force, since all are equally valid or invalid, for all become equally possible where there is no sure starting point and no ascertainable goal of the revolutions of the becoming. Well, Sri Aurobindo is using his gently mocking, ironic humor here to full literary advantage. All these opinions have been held by the human mind, and in all there has been profit, even if we regard them as errors. For errors are permitted to the mind because they open doors upon truth, negatively by destroying opposite errors, positively by preparing an element in a new constructive hypothesis. But pushed too far, this view of things leads to the negation of the whole aim of philosophy, which seeks for knowledge and not for chaos, and which cannot fulfill itself if the last word of knowledge is the unknowable, but only if it is something, to use the words of the Upanishad, which, being known, all is known. This goes to the Mundaka Upanishad, 113, the great answer of the sage to Shaunaka. The unknowable, not absolutely unknowable, but beyond mental knowledge, can only be a higher degree in the intensity of being of that something, a degree beyond the loftiest summit attainable by mental beings. And if it were known, as it must be known to itself, that discovery would not destroy entirely what is given us by our supreme possible knowledge, but rather carry it to a higher fulfillment and larger truth of what it has already gained by self-vision and self-experience. It is, then, this something, an absolute which can be so known that all truths can stand in it and by it and find there their reconciliation, that we must discover as our starting point and keep as our constant base of thinking and seeing, and by it find a solution of the problem. For it is that alone that can carry in it a key to the paradoxes of the universe. By the way, that question, through what being known, great sir, does all this become known? By knowing that, how do we know it all? Kasmin nuum bhagavo vijñāte sarvam idam vijñātam bhavati iti. So I think we rest there. We'll divide this chapter into three sessions. This the first. So we'll finish before Siddhi Day on the 24th of November. And thereafter, take up the 13th chapter. So I've tried to find a passage which would be redolent of tonight's philosophy. Perhaps I've done so. This is in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings. Canto 4, The Secret Knowledge. This is the sailor on the flow of time. This is world matter's slow discoverer, who, launched into this small corporeal birth, has learned his craft in tiny bays of self, but dares at last unplumbed infinitudes, a voyager upon eternity's seas. In his world adventure's crude initial start, behold him, ignorant of his godhead's force, timid initiate of its vast design. An expert captain of a fragile craft, a trafficker in small impermanent wares. At first he hugs the shore and shuns the breaths, dares not to affront the far-off perilous main. He, in a petty coastal traffic, plies, his pay doled out from port to neighbor port. Content with his safe round's unchanging course, he hazards not the new and the unseen. But now he hears the sound of larger seas. A widening world calls him to distant scenes, and journeyings in a larger vision's arc, and peoples unknown, and still unvisited shores. On a commissioned keel, his merchant hull serves the world's commerce in the riches of time, severing the foam of a great landlocked sea to reach unknown harbor lights in distant climes and open markets for life's opulent arts, rich bales, carved statuettes, hued canvases, and jeweled toys brought for an infant's play, and perishable products of hard toil, and transient splendors won and lost by the days. Or, passing through a gate of pillar rocks, venturing not yet to cross oceans unnamed, and journey into a dream of distances, he travels close to unfamiliar coasts, and finds new haven in storm-troubled isles, or, guided by a sure compass in his thought, he plunges through a bright haze that hides the stars, steering on the trade routes of ignorance. His prow pushes towards undiscovered shores. He chances on unimagined continents. A seeker of the islands of the blessed, he leaves the last lands, crosses the ultimate seas. He turns to eternal things his symbol quest. Life changes for him, its time-constructed scenes, its images veiling infinity. Earth's borders recede, and the terrestrial air hangs round him no longer its translucent veil. He has crossed the limit of mortal thought and hope. He has reached the world's end and stares beyond. The eyes of mortal body plunge their gaze into eyes that look upon eternity. A greater world time's traveler must explore. At last he hears a chanting on the heights, and the far speaks, and the unknown grows near. He crosses the boundaries of the unseen, and passes over the edge of mortal sight to a new vision of himself and things. He is a spirit in an unfinished world that knows him not and cannot know itself. The surface symbol of his goalless quest takes deeper meanings to his inner view. His is a search of darkness for the light, of mortal life for immortality. So I thank you for your attention this evening and this morning. Namaste. Jai Ma.